to get our program started here in a moment. Yeah, please come on down and fill in some chairs. Just as fair warning, the program's 3.5 hours long, so you're probably going to want to grab a seat and make yourselves comfortable. Well, thank you all very much for being here tonight. It's great to be in Pasadena. Every time we come to Los Angeles, and we're down here every year or two officially, we try and pick a different spot in the region because we recognize how complex it is to get from one place to another, and we don't want to penalize the same people over and over again by having them have to drive for 4 or 5 hours to get to the event. So whether you're here from Pasadena, and I know there's some folks that are from right in town, or whether you've made a long pilgrimage from some other place in the area, thank you. We appreciate you being here. I want to introduce a few folks to you now who made a fairly long trip themselves, although it occurs to me that the trip from Tacoma down here, depending on how things work out, may not be as long as the trip from Orange County to here. So let me just introduce those people to you. If you haven't had a chance yet, I hope you will before the evening is over to say hello and speak with Mary Thomas. Mary, are you here? There she is. Also, I'd like to introduce some folks from the office, if I may. Allison Kennedy Smith, our Director of Alumni and Parent Relations, is here over to my right. Rainier Element is here from the class of 2010. I'm telling you, he's aging every moment, I need to tell you. Rainier is our Assistant Director of Alumni Relations, a newly minted alumnus. And if you check him out in a little while, get a little close to him, you'll see he's still pretty shiny and not too dinged up. So he's doing well. Michelle Banks is with us as well. Michelle is a development officer with the university, spends a lot of time in Southern California. And I know many of you have met her. And also Rebecca Harrison from the class of one is here, our director of donor relations and campaign programs. The last time we were here in the area, we were at the Dorothy Chandler, I know some of you were there, and we had a two-part program. We featured two faculty members, as we have been doing across the country for the past 3 years or so. Bruce Mann and Doug Goodman were there, a couple of economists talking about the economy and the recession. You'll recall they told us things were going to get better, and I've got a lot of faith in Bruce and Doug, and the clock's ticking. And we also talked a little about the strategic plan and about its four central tenets, which is to innovate, inspire, engage, and invest. And what we wanted to do tonight was provide a little bit of texture for that plan and talk with you in a little more detail about some of the very exciting things that have been going on as this plan has been implemented. And one of them for us, actually two of them for us, both related to the engage piece of the plan, can be visible tonight. Could the folks who are in the Alumni Council raise their hands, please? These are all folks who are volunteering on a 500-member Alumni Council. They're very shy. They're very retiring. And they have done some terrific work for us over the course of the last several years and have really reinvigorated our alumni clubs across the country in addition to a whole host of other activities. And also the Parents Council, another group. If the Parent Council members could raise their hands, be less shy perhaps than the Alumni Council members. That's great. And these Parent Council members too have been doing some great work for us and are two of the manifestations, if you will, of the plan. And again, we're gonna hear about some more in just a minute. And as we were thinking about how best to show this to you and get you to feel this, because really it's a feeling that you need to have, we wondered if words alone could do it. And we thought about this for a long time. We wrote a lot of words down, and we brought a lot of words with us, and you'll hear a lot of words. But before we do that, we wanted to provide a little clip, a little video, a little audio to give you a sense of what's happening here. And immediately following the clip, we'll be joined by a university president who really needs no introduction. University of Puget Sound's 13th president, Ron Thomas. But first, the clip.
Thank you, and it's great to be here in L.A., as Dave said, or Pasadena. Are we technically in L.A.? We're in L.A. County? In the county, right? That's good. Wherever we are, it's great to be here. And Mary and I always love to come down here because, we had actually a few minutes just before this evening's event after we flew in this afternoon to take a little walk, and we both made a point of bringing our sunglasses, and we wore them today. It was an amazing experience, an unusual one for us, but it was one that we really enjoyed. You've just seen in this clip and in the images actually all around the room and in the room outside as you came in, evidence of our strategic plan in action. You also just saw images of a building being built, one that is in fact even further along than it was in January 1st. It's all fully bricked now and the tiles on the roof are going up. And windows are coming in at the end of this week and going in as well. The building is taking a great form. But you've also seen images of the Alumni Parent Council here, a program that we are building at Puget Sound. The two are not distinct in any way. They're actually deeply related. The images of the Center for Health Sciences that you just saw on the screen is, of course, a building where our mission will take place very soon, where the teaching and learning and service to our community will very soon be taking shape in very real form. You've seen images also of the master plan I see right over there in the corner, and building projects to come as well. Clearly, the theme of our program this evening is building in many respects. It's a very versatile word. Building can be used, as I like to say, as an old English professor, as a noun, as a verb, as an adjective. And tonight we'll use them in all three ways as we talk about our university at Puget Sound. Momentum is building on campus. And you can see it symbolized in the amazing building we are constructing right now with some of the most advanced building techniques available. Notice noun, verb, and adjective right there, a gerundive, really. You can also see it in the relationships that we're building. In fact, among many of you right here in this room, with our students, with our faculty, with all of our alumni and parents as well. There's little question if you step onto campus or even talk to one of our alums away from campus that there is a sense of momentum building at the University of Puget Sound. And on the strength of Puget Sound's nearly 123-year history now, we believe that this truly is a defining moment for the University of Puget Sound. We're here to talk to you a little bit tonight. Some of our very closest friends and volunteers and alums about the university and about the strategic plan that we call defining moments, and a bit about the capital campaign that has been quietly in progress for a couple of years now, and which we will soon publicly launch, actually next October, in support of the strategic plan. And the campaign and the strategic plan are both really all about building, about first building relationships, about building our reputation for academic excellence, about building the university's financial resources and strength for these challenging times, and about building the campus, quite literally, itself. Now, any good building, any of us know, begins with the building of a strong foundation. And our work with the campaign and with the strategic plan begins with one of the key objectives of that plan, that is to engage in the building of relationships between the university and our alums, our parents and our friends, and assisting them in building meaningful, enduring relationships among each other as well. We've already seen evidence of our success. Just, I think, 3 years ago when we came to visit you, we presented this spreadsheet for the first time, this rather large spreadsheet as an idea. And now that idea has been peopled by some 500 volunteers across the country in the expanded Parents Council and the enlarged and invigorated regional club network around the country and in the growing LagerNet online community and so on. So I want to thank all of you who have been involved in helping us to build relationships together. And I think it's fair to say that all of us know that any great organization, certainly any fine university, is built upon a foundation of strong relationships and loyalty and mutual respect. And that's exactly what we're seeking to do with our Alumni Council and Parents Council and in the engagement of all of our students, alumni, parents, and friends. Now, the Center for Health Sciences itself is one of the campaign's most important physical objectives. It is our first capital project in the campaign, and already we've been able to come very close to funding the entire thing, which is why we've been able to build it, and we'll have it, in fact, complete before we publicly announce the campaign. It represents the most literal definition of building that I'll use tonight, building an inspiring environment for learning, which is our strategic plan's other key objective. And situated on the south end of campus, the Center for Health Sciences, right there across North 11th Street from Memorial Field House, the Center for Health Sciences will not only unify and provide a home for the programs of psychology and physical therapy and occupational therapy and exercise science and neuroscience for the very first time, bringing these disciplines together for Puget Sound. It will also, from a master plan point of view, physically transform the south end of campus and unify it with the historic center of campus as well, both architecturally and from a planning point of view. We'll finally be able to raise the temporary buildings that have been there on that site since 1948. They were planned to be there for 5 years. And they've been there a bit longer. They will be gone by the time most of you return to campus. Building on our reputation and tradition of leading edge interdisciplinarity, most importantly, this building will bring together these disciplines in a way that will provide synergies and exciting opportunities for our students and faculty who are clinicians, who are teachers, who are practitioners and researchers, and students of all of those disciplines. It will enable us to realize the original vision of the campus, conceived by Dr. Todd back in 1922, but more than twice the size, and with technology and facilities inside our signature Tudor Gothic architecture that Dr. Todd could not, of course, yet have dreamed of back in the 1920s. It is one of Princeton Review's 20 most beautiful campuses, we were told this year by that publication, and will be even more beautiful and impressive next year. The center will grace the east side of the remarkable landscape element that we call Commencement Walk, that traces the path of each graduating class as it processes through the heart of our Tudor Gothic campus from the library all the way to Baker Stadium every year. Commencement Walk itself will unify the campus, will really be a thread that stitches the campus together from north to south, and will complete that vision first imagined by President Todd when he touched blade to earth to break ground for Jones Hall, the first building erected on the campus's current site back in 1922. Now, through the campaign, we're doing other building as well. We're building our endowment. Over one half of our campaign goal will be to support Puget Sound's students and faculty by continuing to build our endowment. A significant portion of that endowment growth will be dedicated exclusively to financial aid. We know that financing a college education is a pressing concern for many students and many families, increasingly so, and we are committed to helping. We know it's also one of the fundamental issues that is facing us in higher education going forward. So it's the single most significant piece of our campaign is a dedication to raising $50 million of endowment for financial aid. What will that support mean for our students? Well, first it means access, of course. It means that many students who haven't the means to pay for their college education, or for a Puget Sound education at least, and would otherwise need to pursue other options, will in fact be able to join us and experience the first-rate residential liberal arts college educational experience that we offer at Puget Sound. It means access. It means excellence as well. It means that students will continue to be able to participate in a class of 12 or 14 students rather than sitting in a class of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 1,500, as I was reading the intro bio class at the University of Washington is at this time. It will mean they will never be taught by a teaching assistant, but always by a full-time faculty member at the University of Puget Sound. It means engagement. It means they will get to know and develop relationships with their professors and their classmates and be part of an intimate academic community that transcends the seminar room but goes into the residence halls and into the cafes and dining hall and playing fields of the campus. It means community. It means they'll be able to exchange ideas in an interactive way, to do research at a local hospital, or out on Mount Rainier, or in Puget Sound itself, or in a community nonprofit in Tacoma or Seattle. Rather than simply taking notes or reading from a computer monitor, it means a kind of academic community that they'll be able to continue to enjoy. And finally, it means success. It means that they will be prepared when they do graduate to creatively and intelligently contribute to society as our alums have done in the past, to address global issues that have endured for years, to continue to make a difference in the world in all of the ways in virtually every field of endeavor that our alums have done in the past and will continue to do in the future. Those who teach our students, our professors, collectively, the faculty, will also benefit from this campaign. Building their strength is an important and essential objective for us as well. And building upon the reputation of our outstanding teachers and scholars, named Princeton Review's top 20 most accessible professors in the country, and acknowledged this year, once again, 3 out of the last 4 years, with Carnegie Foundation's Excellence Award for Professor of the Year, 6 times, in fact, altogether, more than any other college or university in Washington as the Professor of the Year. We will build on that reputation by building our faculty. We will, in fact, add 10 new faculty lines to enhance teaching and to add new expertise in our already innovative and comprehensive curriculum. In fact, we're currently performing the search for the first fully funded chair to come out of the campaign, the Jenny Carruthers Chair in Neuroscience, funded, in fact, by a parent of a graduate and a member of our Board of Trustees right now. Together, these new faculty lines, that's one of 10, will build and transform the curriculum, continue to renew it, and make Puget Sound, continue to make Puget Sound a place where innovation is central to the curriculum and to our teaching and to the scholarship of the university. The holder of the Carruthers Chair that I just mentioned will build upon the new concentration in neuroscience that we have developed at Puget Sound in the last couple of years. And together with colleagues from the undergraduate programs of psychology and exercise science and those graduate clinical programs in physical therapy and occupational therapy, will provide a one-of-a-kind, unified academic experience that focuses on the health of the mind and the body. Their work will take place in our newly constructed Center for Health Sciences that you just saw going up at breakneck speed a few moments ago, the only such center found in a liberal arts college anywhere in the nation. Now, one of the most important rooms, actually, in that new building is a small room. It's the faculty office of Professor Mark Reines. And I actually visited your office the other day, Mark. It has a fantastic view, I think you'll be glad to hear. And Mark is going to be with us here tonight from the psychology department to share a little bit about what it might be like to take a course from Professor Mark Reinitz. Mark teaches in the Department of Psychology, and he and his students will soon, as I mentioned earlier, and referred to his office, call the new Center for Health Sciences their home. I can think of no better way, really, to describe the Puget Sound strategic plan in action than to introduce one of our most engaging faculty members and distinguished faculty members. They're all engaging and distinguished, of course, but Mark is truly unique. He, along with his colleagues, really are our great asset. I'm delighted that Mark has made the trip down here with us tonight, and I know that several of the alums that I talked to were psychology majors and remember Mark well, and are here tonight to get a little refresher course from him. He's taught at Puget Sound since 1999. His BA is from Hampshire College, and his PhD in experimental psychology from the University of Washington. Those of you who might have attended the alumni college at last summer's reunion will remember Mark's address on memory illusions. If you don't remember, you know why you don't remember as a result of taking that class. But Mark has been a consultant, an expert witness about memory and perception on a number of legal cases and continues to be called upon. As indicated by the title of his presentation tonight, Professor Reinitz will explore some of the ways that memory can be an inaccurate recall of dramatic events. So it's my great pleasure to introduce one of our most popular, engaging, compelling, and entertaining teachers. You better be good, Mark, I tell you. That's awesome. Mark Reinitz, come on up, Mark.
All right, thank you very much. I do want to take one moment to mention to all of you that the faculty are very thankful for the help that many of you have provided in creating this new building that I'll get to move into. I don't know how many of you have ever been down to the basement of Howarth Hall, where the psychology department currently is housed, but trust me when I say it's a scary place. And we're really excited to be moving into much more delightful quarters. I'm also, I'll mention very quickly, on the search committee for the neuroscience position that Ron just mentioned, and I will report that we have been delighted with the quality of the applicants, and in fact, our first applicant is coming to campus this week. So we're excited and things are going well. So I'm Mark Reinitz, as you know. My two areas of expertise are perception, which is how people get information out of the world using their sense organs, and then memory, which is how people think back on that information that they acquired from the world. And this makes me well suited for serving as an expert witness in court cases when the primary evidence at hand is an eyewitness account of what happened. Because if an eyewitness is going to be wrong, it's usually going to be for one of two reasons. Either they never perceived what happened very well to begin with, or they did perceive fairly accurately, but over time, their memory for what happened changed. And I can comment on both of those potential situations, as I'm sometimes asked to do. What I am going to start doing here is, in a moment, I'm going to give you some stimuli up on the screen for you to remember, and then later I'll ask you to try to recall. Now, I have a question for you. Is it possible to distribute? Does that work? If you started it now, that would be good. And so in the meantime, what I'm going to try to do is talk about issues specifically relating to memory that arise in the courtroom. I'm going to then talk a little bit about various ways in which people study memory. And then finally, I'd like to give you a couple examples of research that I've done with students and colleagues at University of the South. Okay, one thing that people are often asked to remember as eyewitnesses are faces. And I didn't want to show you photographs of faces because those are so hard. So I just made simple line drawings of faces with the assumption that certainly everyone will have no problem remembering these faces. Not only that, I'm only going to show you four of them. So I'll show you four faces. Later I'll show you some new faces. I don't have to say which ones you saw. Should be easy. So here are the faces. Ha! Another thing that people are often asked to recall or to provide information about are real-world events that they witness. I'm not going to stage a real-world event here, but what I'll do is I'll show you a series of slides that tell a story, and then later perhaps ask you what you remember about them. So here's the story. Okay, so I'll test your memory about those things in a little while, but first, just since I said I would provide you with examples of how people study memory, one of the simplest ways is simply to read a bunch of words and then have people remember what words were presented. So I am going to read you a list of words. No one will get all of them right. It's 45 words. After I read all 45 words, I will say, recall, and then I'll give you just a minute or two to write down all the words that you remember from the list. Okay? So, again, hopefully we'll see some characteristic patterns that occur in memory experiments. Are you going to do this, Ron? Good. Okay. Here we go. So, table, sit, legs, seat, couch, desk, recliner, sofa, wood, cushion, wivel, stool, sitting, rocking, bench, Fred, pin, eye, sewing, sharp, point, brick, thimble, haystack, thorn, hurt, injection, syringe, cloth, knitting, sour, candy, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, ice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, tart, eye, ball. All right, well, I don't want to take too much time with this. And you can have the calculation of knowing if you only wrote down 9 words. If I'd given you more time, you would have gotten all of them. It turns out, I don't think anyone here will be surprised to learn that it's not the case that all words on a list are equally likely to be remembered. Instead, some words are much more likely on a list to be remembered than others. For instance, the first few words on a list tend to be well remembered. The very first word was table. How many of you remember table? Whoa, look at that. The last couple of words also tend to be well remembered, but not quite as well as the first few. The very last word that I read was pie. How many people remember pie? Whoa, good work. Words in the middle of the list typically are not well remembered. So for instance, how many people remember bench? Well, some do, but only about 4 of you. So you are a special person. But these are words that are much less likely to be remembered unless they are somehow central to other words. So, for instance, how many people remembered chair? And what about needle? And what about sweet? Okay, so those words are well remembered. Now, I mentioned that I often testify in court as an expert witness, and in court, if somebody claims to remember something, that's really important. Here it doesn't matter, right? If you're just raising your hand, but in court, if someone says, yes, I remember that, that can seal someone's fate and not in a good way, especially if they're innocent. So having said that, here's something you didn't know about me. I'm accused of being a drug dealer, and you're the witnesses. And the critical question is, do you you remember, you testified in court that you remember hearing me say the word needle. That was on the list that I read. How many of you would condemn me? Only about six of you are raising your hands, even though many of you have read it down. Well, it turns out the needle was not on the list. Neither was the word chair, and neither was the word sweep. None of these words were on the list. And yet, many of you were asserting with confidence that you remembered these words. You certainly wrote them down. It turns out, by the way, that this cute little trick was developed way back in 1959. By a fellow named Deese. What he did was he went into large classes, the kinds of classes that Ron talked about, that previously had 1,500 students, and would read a list of words and ask everyone to write down the first word that came to mind. And he took the 15 most common responses to words like sweep and chair and needle and put those on a list and found that when you read a set of associates of a word, people tend to falsely remember having heard the word itself. The only purpose of this exercise is to show that it's surprisingly easy to create a situation where people claim to remember something that never happened at all. And this is one example of, as Ron mentioned, a relatively new topic of interest within memory research called the study of memory illusions. A memory illusion occurs, just as in here, when you can cause people to confidently remember something that didn't actually happen. Memory illusions have applications to daily life, but they're especially relevant in the courtroom because, as I said, it would be bad if the basis of a confident eyewitness's testimony was a memory illusion rather than information that they had actually encountered during whatever it was that they witnessed. I will just mention briefly that in the last 5 years, there's a group some of you have heard of, I'm sure, called the Innocence Project. It has the goal of helping to exonerate people who were in prison for crimes that it turns out they didn't commit. In the last 5 years, well over 100 people have been exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence that demonstrated conclusively that this person could not have committed the crime that they were convicted of. It turns out that the vast majority of these cases are sexual assault cases. You might ask yourself, why would this be? Why sexual assault cases? This is a situation where the witness is so traumatized that their memory is likely to fail. That's not the answer. The answer is that in order to be exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence, there needs to be some source of DNA left behind at the scene. That's obviously the case often in sexual assault cases. And if it's true that often people are falsely recognized and falsely convicted for sexual assault cases, then you have to imagine that it's probably true that this happens in other crimes as well. And if you're convicted of murder or of assault or of theft or of robbery or some other crime where there doesn't happen to be any source of DNA left behind that can be used later to exonerate you, then you're just out of luck. Okay? One famous example, by the way, is some of you may have heard of it. A woman named Jennifer Thompson in North Carolina was raped. This was, I guess, about 12 years ago. The police picked up a person named Ron Cotton. She positively identified him. When she testified in court, she pointed at him. She was asked, how sure are you that it's him? She pointed at him and said, I'm so sure that if he were convicted of the death penalty, I would gladly pull the switch. And on the basis of this very compelling testimony, he was found guilty. And it wasn't until 10 years later where, on the basis of DNA evidence, it was found that he could not possibly have committed the crime. And in fact, the real rapist who was in prison admitted to it. And Jennifer Thompson felt terrible, as you might imagine. She felt incredibly guilty, and she actually went to find Ron Cotton and to beg his forgiveness. And they became friends, and they now travel around the country giving talks about the dangers of false identifications by eyewitnesses. I'm going to very briefly mention a few early examples of memory illusions that are specifically relevant to the courtroom. Some of you may have heard of Elizabeth Loftus. She has lots of honorary law degrees from many universities around the country because she's the first person ever to testify as an expert witness about an eyewitness's account of what happened. She's quite a famous researcher. She is most famous for showing how post-event information that you hear after the crime's already over, how that information can alter or influence what you remember about the crime. Her first really famous experiments were very simple. People saw a videotape of a red car going through a yield sign and hitting a blue car. And then they were asked, they filled out a questionnaire, and on the questionnaire, one of the questions asked, about how fast would you say that red car was going when it went through the stop sign and hit the blue car? Kind of threw in false information about what type of sign was there in a way that people wouldn't notice, because the question is about the speed of the vehicle, not about what kind of sign was there. Later, people were given a recognition test where two pictures are put up on a screen in front of them. One is the actual picture they saw before of the car going past the yield sign. Another is a new picture where the yield sign has been replaced by a stop sign. The people who weren't given that one trick question, they were right 75% of the time, the picture they saw before. But the ones who had the stop sign mentioned to them, they were incorrect well more than half the time. That is, it seems as if that stop sign that was mentioned after the event became integrated into their memory, and that replaced the yield sign. That's what they now remember having seen. In another famous experiment, and this won't be a surprise to anyone, she used the exact same videotape, but this time people answered one of three questions. About how fast would you say the red car was going when it bumped into the blue car, hit the blue car, or smashed into the blue car? Not surprisingly, as the intensity of the verb increased, so did estimates of speed. But the most interesting thing is that this verb served in a subtle way as a form of post-event information that implied that the accident was more violent than they initially remembered. And evidence for this is at the end of the questionnaire was a question that said, do you remember any broken glass at the accident scene? The people who got the smashed into question were three times as likely as the people who got the bumped into question to claim they remember broken glass when there hadn't actually been any broken glass. And so what that implies is that this information implying a more violent event caused them to reconstruct their memory so it was consistent with this new understanding of what the event was. As I say here, it's easy to see how these cases specifically can relate to eyewitness testimony. If I have time, I'd tell you a very funny story, but I don't feel like I should hear it now. Post-event information has been used in research not only to make people falsely remember stop signs, but to remember entire complex traumatic events. For instance, Bethlofis was able to get people to remember in detail a childhood event that never happened to them, which involved getting lost in a mall for an extended period of time, being helped by a woman in a red jacket who brought the child to a place where they announced over the PA system that there was a lost child, the parents came. A fellow named Steve Cici was able to get the majority of his participants to remember that they had, as a child, put their hand, had a mousetrap closed on their finger so tightly that they had to go to the doctor to have it removed. I wanted to take a minute to talk about this Lost in the Mall study to tell you how it worked. It's really interesting. She knew who the people in her experiment were going to be ahead of time because they were the students in her class. And what she did at the start of the semester was she wrote a letter to all of the parents of all of the kids in her class and said, I'm doing this experiment and I'd like your help. I would like you to provide three stories of events that happened to your child between the ages of 3 and 7. In addition, I would like you to verify that this story, the Lost in the Mall story, never happened to your child. And then what she told the participants was, we got four stories about your childhood from your mom. And we want you to read all of them because we're interested in how well you can remember stuff that happened to you when you were a kid. And at first people said, I remember the other two. I don't remember the being lost in the mall that well, but it does sound familiar. What she said was, well, think about it and come back next week and see if you remember more about it. And when they came back the next week, all of a sudden people were saying, I remember now, you know, every time I remember the perfume that lady was wearing, and every time I smell the perfume, it like fills me with like a feeling of peace. So these are actual stories that people told. So she was able to, over time, implant this. And I want to mention very quickly that her motivation wasn't just to show she could implant the story. It was a more controversial reason, which is some of you may know that a common way, apparently, for people to remember that they were sexually abused as children is by what are called recovered memories. Sometimes people will forget about their abuse for many years, and then either during therapy or spontaneously remember this event. This has been explained by Freudian theory as a result of repression. Being abused is horrible and traumatic, and so it's forced into the unconscious. At some later time, you reach some developmental state where you can now deal with it, and it comes into consciousness, and you can release it, and it's cathartic, and you can become healthier, or whatever. What Elizabeth Loftus wanted to argue was perhaps sometimes these recovered memories aren't real. And that's important, because you're allowed to press charges in most states. In Washington, it doesn't matter how long ago it was. There's a statute of limitations for most crimes, but not for this, because there's a special doctrine called the doctrine of delayed discovery. It's like, imagine you had surgery, and a doctor left a piece of gauze in you, and no one knew for 15 years, and you started having horrible pains, and they do an x-ray, there's something in you. You couldn't have sued the doctor prior to discovering that gauze, because you never knew it was there. And so you're allowed to sue on the basis of the doctrine of delayed discovery. The same exact thing is true for recovered memories of childhood abuse. They were sexual abuse. It was repressed. You weren't conscious of it. There was no way for you to know what happened until it was recovered. And so now you can press charges. So Elizabeth Loftus wanted to argue that sometimes perhaps these aren't real memories. And so what she tried to do in her Lost in the Mall study was to mirror what might happen between a client and a bad therapist, where the therapist might say, the pattern of symptoms that you show is consistent with somebody who's been abused as a child. Did that ever happen to you? Well, no. Well, you act so much like that. I'd like you to think about it. Come back next week. Let's talk more about it. In both cases, there's a kind of trustworthy and authoritative figure suggesting that this happened. There's a request to think about it and come back. This is certainly not to imply, by the way, that all recovered memories of sexual abuse are false. In fact, there's a lot of recent evidence that implies that often they're real. So I don't mean to belittle anyone who recovered a memory of being abused as a child. But the point is, if the only evidence against someone is a recovered memory, there's no physical evidence to corroborate it, should that in and of itself be enough to send someone to prison? And Elizabeth Loftus's argument is no, it shouldn't. There's a reasonable chance that real. The rest of my talk, I think, will be quick. I wanted to talk briefly about another type of memory illusion that I've studied a lot. And this is called causal inference errors. These occur when somebody makes an inference and later forgets it was an inference. They think it's something they actually had witnessed. With a student named Sharon Hannigan, Sharon and I published some articles about this topic that showed what I just said, that people will mistake their inferences for things they actually witnessed. It's a very simple procedure that we use. People viewed slide sequences that told a story. In this case, they were very typical stories, like going to a supermarket, getting a cart, putting things in it, waiting in line to pay, going into your car, putting this up in the back of the car, and so on. But some of the slideshows included a surprising picture, like this, of the person picking up oranges off the floor. The purpose of this was to cause people to make an inference. Oh, she knocked over oranges. She must have pulled an orange from the bottom of a sack or something. They never saw that picture. But later, in the recognition test, we include pictures that were intended to capture that inference. So, for instance, there is an example cause slide, we call it, the most likely cause for the inference slide they saw. Okay. I should mention, by the way, that that's actually my mom, because I didn't have the original pictures, and she was so kind as to pose. So the important thing to understand is that in the experimental condition, people, that inference slide is included, they saw that as part of their slideshow. In the control condition, everything was the same except that one slide was omitted, so there was, for instance, no reason to infer that the person had pulled an orange out and knocked some over. And here's what happened. When people don't see the inference slide, they only say, yeah, I saw that woman pulling the orange about 27% of the time. But when they do, suddenly they assert with confidence nearly 70% of the time that they saw an event that they never saw, they only inferred, right? And so this has potential relevance to eyewitness testimony in that it would be bad for a witness to be testifying that they saw the person perform some action when the witness only inferred that that person must have performed that action. Carolyn Weiss, another faculty member in the psychology department, and I recently completed a series of experiments that demonstrated that this same phenomenon works when the slideshows depict potential crimes, right? So for instance, you don't have to answer me, but you might wonder, did you see this picture? The correct answer is no. You did not see this picture of this man taking her purse. But what you did see is a slide that suggested that it must have happened because there he's around the corner with her purse. And indeed, just like with oranges, when you include this picture in the sequence, all of a sudden people are quite likely to claim, yes, I saw him take it, which would be a bad thing to say in court. I should mention, by the way, I don't have time to talk about it, but another thing we tested was whether stereotyping plays a role in this process. We had the same slide sequence, but half the people saw a black actor, half the people saw a white actor, and the mere act of being black greatly increased the likelihood that people would assert take the bag from the cart. Here's the last little section of the talk. I told you I would test your memory for faces, so here they are. So you can just murmur or whatever if you think you saw the face. So here's one, here's another, another, another. All right, only the second face had been presented before. Yes, but the third face, the first face, was half old and half new. You had seen the eyes and the nose, but not the hair of the mouth. The second face was completely old. The third face was all old parts, but taken from separate faces and recombined to make a new face made of old parts. I call those kinds of faces conjunction faces. So here's an example where the left two faces might be faces that you actually saw, and then the right-hand face is their conjunction where parts are taken from separate faces and put together to make this. And in this kind of experiment, just like you saw four kinds of faces, new faces are faces that are made completely of brand new parts, nothing about them has been seen before. Old faces are faces you really saw. Feature faces are faces that are half old and half new. And you can see that still only 19% of the time, at least in this experiment, the people claim to have seen those. But when all the parts are old but in a new combination, suddenly more than half the time, people confidently claim that they saw this. This happens for lots of different kinds of stimuli. It works for words where I can present eyelid and wine glass and people will write down in a recall test eyeglass, or they will say this out if I show it to them, did you see this before? Even works for cityscapes. We did an experiment with a student named Bill, who he and I did an experiment where we actually took cityscapes. We photoshopped out half the buildings. We had places like Nashville, Tennessee, and Cincinnati, Ohio. And we take buildings and make new cityscapes from combining the old ones after people had studied the actual cityscapes. And people were very, yes, I saw that. I definitely saw that, even though it's a new place made up of recombined buildings. And what this tells us is that memories aren't these holistic entities. They're made out of parts. And people can mix up those parts when they remember. Right? And just as a kind of closing statement, I fairly recently testified in a case right in Tacoma at the Pierce County Superior Court where a man had robbed a 7-Eleven at gunpoint. And a week later, this guy comes into the 7-Eleven, and the cashier recognizes him as the guy who robbed the store, but he was worried that he had a gun, so he just followed him out and wrote down his license plate number and then called the police and said, the guy who robbed us last week just came in.
And I got his license plate number, so the police went to the guy's house, arrested him, and said, why are you arresting me? He said, because the cashier prostitute identified you as the person who robbed the 7-Eleven. And he said, I know that 7-Eleven. I go in there all the time. I didn't rob it. I went in there. I knew something had happened. There were police all over the place. I just went in, I bought a can of pop, and I left. Right, and they actually imprisoned the guy. He had a criminal record previously. I testified that there's a phenomenon called unconscious transference, which occurs when people, sometimes it's called the innocent bystander effect, where people see someone at or near the time of a crime, and then misremember them as the perpetrator. And it is the case that when the security videos were reviewed, they were completely consistent with this defendant's story of coming in after the crime had already been committed, the jury found innocent, and really obviously, really rightly so. So, conclusion. Hopefully I've convinced you that there are a lot of reasons to be dubious in some cases about eyewitness testimony. People can be quite confident they're not lying. They think they're remembering correctly, but there are many, many reasons why they might be remembering incorrectly. I only skimmed the surface, and this talk brings up the time I have. And so, obviously, you need to be careful in how much you should trust eyewitnesses in specific situations, especially because, in general, confident eyewitness is about the most compelling evidence there is. There's a famous case in Chicago about 15 years ago where only two witnesses took the stand. One was a victim who pointed at the person and said, I am absolutely certain it's him. I have no doubt. That face is etched in my mind. The other person who spoke was a DNA expert from the FBI who said, the odds of this being a person are less than 1 in 10,000. But my final comment is that despite the fact that eyewitness accounts aren't always accurate, our memories are really good, not bad. I don't mean to be implied, oh, we have bad memories, we should all be ashamed of ourselves. Because memory lets us do all the stuff that we want to do, right? We can have our jobs and do them well. We can have social relationships. All the things that are integral to having successful and satisfying lives, we're able to do, which means that our memory must work well, right? It lets us do all the stuff we want. The thing is, though, that the courtroom is a special case. It's one of the only cases where we have to divorce ourselves from subjectivity and give, like, a little video recorder an account of what happened. That's not normal real life situation. That's not how we've evolved. That's not what memory developed for. And so in that one special case, we're bad, but more generally, we're really good. So that's my final comment. Thank you. My understanding is that now I don't know how much time we have. I don't think I went over by too much. But we're this just open the floor to questions. Yeah.
Is there a way of using the flaws in memory?
That's an interesting question. So can you take advantage of how memory works to enhance, for instance, educational curriculum? Use the same techniques to make people falsely remember things to make them remember things well.
Yes.
And I would say, though it would be hard for me to give a specific example without going into more detail, I would say that most people who study memory illusions don't study memory illusions because they're interested in the errors people make. They study memory illusions because they provide insight into how normal memory works. And so I think that by understanding the ways in which memory goes wrong and understanding what exactly is the mechanism that produces that error, we come to better understand how we learn and remember in general. And there are certainly many people who study memory illusions with specific emphasis on education. One person is very famous, is named Roger III, and he prefers to be known as Ronnie Roger. And one of his findings that I love, I want Ron to be aware of this in case I ever get bad at teaching evaluations, is he's actually shown that slightly disorganized lectures lead to better learning than highly organized ones. Because when the lecture is highly organized, there's no mental effort on the part of the learner to encode the information. But when it's slightly disorganized, the person has to make the connections themselves, which leads to better learning. So, just in case.
How
would you count?
Well, there are a number of considerations there. The first consideration is that I would never be allowed to testify, right, it's up to the judge, and I wouldn't be allowed to testify unless there was significant reason to believe that my testimony was warranted in this particular situation. So it's not as if I called in for any case when an eyewitness says anything. I don't need to imply that I think eyewitnesses are useless and should be banned or anything like that, but some people have actually made that argument. You know, prosecutors get to cross-examine you, and prosecutors are smart. And they, you know, do what they do, and you have to, you know, the two things that are true are whenever you go in as a witness, you're not an advocate. I typically testify for the defense, but you're not an advocate for the defense. You're just there to provide information, and you have to answer truthfully. And in fact, many times when lawyers have called me for advice, I said, you know, there's nothing to help you, I'm just going to help you here. So most of the time, a witness has to know someone never would be called. But when I have, you know, I have to answer truthfully when the prosecutor asks me questions too. The prosecutor will say things like, "Now, can you comment on distance? Is distance important for face recognition?" "Yes, how is it important?" "Well, if someone's closer, better able to recognize the face later than the far." "In this case, would you say that the witness was close to the person? Were they close enough for good perception?" "Yes." So the prosecutor thinks of what to say too, and they get points the other direction. So,
I think that the general consensus is that memory is best immediately following an event, or less likely to go downhill from that point. The way that memories get better, if you rehearse in your head certain critical events that happen, they will become stronger in memory. You'll remember them well. However, as time goes on, there's more and more opportunity for various sources of information to influence recording what you recall is originally happening. And in general, the kind of cases where I personally tend to be called in are where the initial description on the part of a witness is vague. They say, "Yeah, I think he was a white guy. He was like between 5'7" and 6 feet tall. I didn't really get a good look at his face." And then 3 months later, it's like, "You know, at first I didn't remember him, but now I remember it was him." That's just not right. That memory doesn't get better. It gets worse. And if they didn't know what the person looked like at first, there's absolutely no scientific basis to say, but later they will know what they look like. It just doesn't happen.
It's more along the
line. But that's different. Not being able to remember at all is different than having one memory and then having a different. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's never the case that over time I work about an event. And in fact, there are some questioning techniques that the police sometimes use that have actually been shown to improve memory by reinstating context. For instance, having a witness, remember the event and then remembering it backwards. Without any suggestion of any sort on the part of the police officer, and this reinstatement of context often brings to mind new details that were lacking from the original report. So, yes, and so I would not deny that there are some questioning techniques that can actually enhance memory, though it's much more common in those kinds of cases where new details come up. They don't replace old details, but instead augment them. And so replacing one memory with another, I think, is dicey. Yeah. Anxiety is interesting, so probably some of you remember if you took psychoanalysis, and it's famous for years of years ago, that shows how well people tend to perform as a function of how aroused they are. And not surprisingly, if people are very low arousal, they perform very badly because they're basically comatose, right? And so as arousal increases, performance increases as well, up to a point. But then beyond that point, there's too much arousal and performance plummets. And so usually anxiety is a form of arousal, And when people are very anxious, it's going to lead to poor memory. This is exactly the same thing as stage fright. This is why you're watching Wheel of Fortune and it says fast food restaurant, MCD, blank, 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 LDS. And you're like, right? But that person's there and they're super aroused. I know people are looking at them, they're anxious, and it just decreases their mental functioning, including their memory. But when someone's very aroused during the actual event, like if someone's waving a gun and you're a witness, that arousal has also been shown to vastly decrease the quality of the initial memory. That's just the kind of memory that's most prone for distortion after, when the original memory isn't very strong. Arousal at the time of the event is high.
This most people with photographic memory, facts, and those are things. They're all also able to process well, or is it limited because of their other?
That's a very interesting question. It would be like a novel, right? Some person who's a savant who witnesses, and like some aspects are incredibly accurate, but other aspects that everyone else can get at are terrible. That'd be way cool. But I've never heard of anything. One thing I will say, that not only savants have what you're calling photographic memory, which more commonly referred to as eidetic imagery, where people can make and maintain very vivid visual representations of something they've seen. It's also fairly common in children, much more common in children than adults. It's something that tends to disappear as people get older. But studies have shown that even in these cases, there are inaccuracies in their memories. So for instance, when people are shown a series of buildings and they're asked to draw what their image, they often have the wrong number of stories on the various buildings and so on, which shows that even photographic memory isn't nearly as photographic as some people would think.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Mark. That was terrific. As you can see, Mark lived up to my introduction. Don't you think he did? excuse me. I like to put you under a little pressure, Mark, actually, and you performed very well. I'm really happy that you've all had a chance to hear from Mark and to see a little bit about what's happening on campus. Together with you, together with our faculty, together with all of us on the team back on campus, we will continue to build our university. And not just physically, obviously. We'll continue to build support for our dedicated faculty like Mark, and access for our most talented students, like many of your sons and daughters who are here tonight. Maintaining quality and diversity among our student body. Building relationships with you and among you. Building the financial strength of the university for the future. And building the reputation of a great college into an even greater one. In order to achieve our vision and to continue the great mission and purpose that Puget Sound exists for, we will need to complete a successful, comprehensive campaign of unprecedented size and scale for our university. And I'd like you all to go home and think about it, as Mark said. I'd like you to think about what role you might want to have in building the university for the future. In all of the ways that we've been talking about tonight, as engaged volunteers, as many of you are, assisting with admission work, with regional programming, with career counseling for our students and mentoring, reunion planning, as donors to the Alumni Fund, to the Parents Fund, or the Friends Fund, helping to set up an endowment for financial aid for students for the future, for building our campus in ways like the Center for Health Sciences shows, or the new athletic center that we're preparing now to plan for. As proud parents and alumni who share your experiences and continue to build Puget Sound's reputation, I hope you will find your place in this great purpose. Many of you have already pitched in so generously, and we so deeply appreciate it. We're grateful to you. We're grateful to you for sharing your time with us tonight as well. But there is still much work to be done, much more building to do at Puget Sound, and it shall always be so. And we hope that you will take an important part, a part that's meaningful for you in that process. And I'm confident that through our engagement together, our investment together, we will continue to build a culture of excellence at Puget Sound, a culture of engagement and philanthropy that will move us forward into the future confidently. In what I do believe is a defining moment for Puget Sound as we take our place among the very best liberal arts colleges in the country. Now, there is a show after the show tonight that I want to mention. Many of you have had a chance to meet Associate Vice President for Facilities, Bob Keefe. Bob, would you wave your hand? He's the guy with the white hair. I've given him a lot of those white hairs, actually. But Bob is in charge of all the facilities at Puget Sound. He's in charge of the implementation of our master plan. He's in charge of the building project that you saw earlier. And he's actually going to transport you through time and space. And in that little screen off to the left that you saw when you came in, Bob is going to provide you with a virtual tour of Commencement Walk and the new completed, brand new Center for Health Sciences as it appears in highly dependable computer modeling. That you will leave here thinking you've actually seen the new building. And you'll get one of the first tours of the new building as it is completed this coming May. So you'll get a chance to do something that no one else has done yet. We also have some things for you to take home to remember us by tonight. Some Puget Sound materials, even some sweets. So be sure to collect them on your departure. And don't go away too soon. Stick around, enjoy each other. Enjoy the bar, which will be open for a while longer. Have another glass of wine or beer or sparkling water for the courageous among you. And again, thank you so much for being with us here tonight, for all the support that you've offered us at Puget Sound, for sending your sons and daughters, for those of you who are alumni, for remaining loyal alumni and continuing to support the university in so many ways. Now my eighth year as president, Mary and I are so honored to be part of this family and appreciate every one of you and appreciate the time that you spent with us here tonight. So continue to enjoy. Thanks for helping us to build a great university.